Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Scott Raish of Crime Talk. And we had the distinct honor of interviewing Cheryl Lynn Cadle, the author of Letters from Christopher, A Tragic Confession of the Watts Family Murders. Now, I received an advance copy of the book, and I requested it so that I could have a substantive conversation with Cheryl Lynn. I'll admit to you, at first I was very skeptical. She lays out factually what is known through a lot of public information. And whether you're interested in what she has to say or not is completely up to you. I thought it was worthwhile speaking to her because, whether you like it or not, she is one of the few people who has actually spoken with Christopher Watts. She has his letters, and she states he's guilty. This book is not a fan club for Chris Watts. This is not being an advocate for anyone. It's simply laying out what he said. You don't have to necessarily buy the book, but I hope you watch the video. I think it will be interesting for you, and I think you will see that this was not a book written to support Chris Watts or anyone involved in this particular case. I'm not telling you to buy the book, but I think you may want to listen to the interview, and then you can make the decision. And that's what we've always tried to do here on Crime Talk, was simply, let's look at the facts. You don't have to agree with this, but you decide. And obviously, when you watch the video, let's talk about it. All right. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Scott Raish of Crime Talk, and today we have a special guest. And for a lot of people that have subscribed to this channel, they were brought to this channel because of the situation in Frederick, Colorado regarding Chris Watts. Well, most people are aware of the facts of the case, and obviously, Chris Watts is now in prison and will remain there for a lot of time. And this is a very unusual case in that so much discovery was actually released in this case. Not all of it, but a very large portion of it, which is very unusual for such public dissemination in a criminal case, not only here in Colorado, but just about anywhere that I've seen. And, well, Chris Watts has been in prison. He has met and corresponded with our guest today. And today is our guest, Cheryl Lynn Cadle. She is the author of Letters from Christopher, A Tragic Confession of the Watts Family Murders. So, Cheryl Lynn, first of all, thank you for joining me here today. I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to do this. How are you?
You're welcome, and I'm fine. Thank you for having me, Scott.
All right. So let's, a couple of quick questions. Why don't you give me a quick, bio about yourself? What do you do? Is, your writing experience? Why don't you just go from there?
Well, my writing experience has just been small blurbs in our local newspaper. Years ago, I had a little thing in Reader's Digest. I've never written a full book before and had it published, but this one just was different for me. I just really felt like I wanted to get the story out.
Okay. And just out of full disclosure here, you or your publisher, when we were coordinating, and wanted to make sure we were able to have a good conversation, I was provided an advanced copy of this book. I have, in fact, read the book, and part of my agreement with you all is that I would not release anything until Monday, this coming Monday, this video about that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. But like I said, I have read the book. And as you can see, I've even tabbed some really good points. Yeah. And use my pen as well. So what I think that really jumped out at me first in this case, and I think a lot of people when you bring up the Watts case and says, oh, there's a book about, you know, Chris Watts or letters that he wrote, that it was going to be some sort of, and I don't mean this like Chris Watts, he does apologize, but it's not anyone saying, oh, he was a, you know, it's someone else's fault. I think it was rather clear in your foreword where you acknowledge that he's guilty.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
And so I thought that was kind of a good start. And I've had lots of people, when I do my channel and there's stuff about Chris Watts, is I'm like, listen, he's pled guilty, all right? Whether you like it or not, whether you think they're or mitigating circumstances or aggravating circumstances, the reality of it is that he pled guilty, and that's a fact, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So why don't you tell everyone out there how it is you came to start writing Chris Watts? Why?
Well, I saw it on TV the day that he had the infamous front porch interview. And watching that interview, I knew that there was something really hidden in him. I could tell by watching him that he was guilty. And I wanted to know more. So as a little bit of time went by, we didn't hear anything as to what happened other than he was just guilty and that was it. I decided I wanted to write that story. So from the very first letter I wrote Christopher, I was very clear that I thought the crime was heinous. I told him that, and I asked him if he would like to tell his story, because I believed that he had much more to the story. That was right before, that was the beginning of February, and so that was right before the FBI came out to see him, and he agreed with me through back and forth correspondence a few times that he would like to give me his story. So when I went to see him, we made an agreement. He would not receive any money. He can't receive any money.
Okay.
And in exchange for that, he would just give me the story if I would write about his forgiveness in the book. And so we agreed and went forward from there.
Okay. Yeah, and obviously, you know, I think everybody wants to make sure he wasn't going to profit in any way. And, you know, there's a sale of the house going on up there in Frederick, and it's been delayed so that, you know, I've speculated. Obviously, I've looked at the court file, but it looks like the, you know, process has been delayed. And I think a lot of that is there's a civil suit, but they want to make sure that kind of that gets resolved and they can attach it and the value's there, that so the money would go to the Ruzick family.
Correct.
So that's good. Now, obviously, you're not giving the book away. You're going to sell it. What do you intend to do, if anything, if you have any profits from this? Is it going to go to any charity, or are you going to keep it for yourself? Which is perfectly fine in my book, because you know, it's your work. You should be rewarded for your work. So if that's
right,
what you're going to do, that's fine too.
Well, some of each. I mean, I certainly am going to donate some money to a few different causes. And how much yet, I don't know, because I have no idea how much the book is going to make.
Sure.
I had quite an outlay in doing the book myself, so I have to pay myself back into my savings for that first.
Sure.
And then make a decision how to split up between some of the charities and myself. It's sure. been 6 months of grueling work that I have done to get the book out as quickly as I have.
No, I understand completely. And, you know, we all, our time is valuable. You have resources, you know, you've traveled, and we'll get into that as well. But, yeah, I mean, I have no problem if people are going to, for lack of a better term, you know, write a book and people enjoy it. You should be rewarded for that. So I'm not, please don't take it as any kind of a criticism, you know, whatsoever.
Oh, no.
And I'm sure you've noticed, we were talking about it, we went live today on our channel, and, you know, one thing that being on YouTube will do is certainly gives you thick skin, because no matter what you do, somebody's not going to like what you say, how you said it.
Oh boy.
So, you know, there's some people that no matter what, they're not going to listen to it. They're not going to read it. It's, they've made their minds up and they're not going to do anything. So.
Right. Right.
And
that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's okay. But I've always looked at it as like, you know, let's talk about the facts. These are what happened. This is the reality. And I think that what you did laying out the facts, you know, kind of a history to give the people a history of what's going on. You know, a lot of it is, you know, it's public knowledge. I mean, obviously a lot of the stuff that came out about Christopher Watts from the beginning of this case to the end, I mean, there's so much information out there about him. And if you follow the case, but for an everyday person who hasn't been following this case on an everyday basis, like so many people have, I think your book is a good backdrop and provides a good history. And you work in, you know, your conversations with Chris Watts to give it that context. And like I said, I really noticed the first thing was in the foreword. You're like, you're not here to apologize for Chris Watts. You're not here to say he's, you know, poor Chris Watts. He made his decisions and, you know, he accepted responsibility for it. But yeah, I understand your thinking of what's making him tick, right?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, he's a murderer and there's something in his mind that has obviously disconnected, and caused him to do something so horrible. And then even though he admits it, still having problems with saying I am a murderer, or having problems with being called that, or having problems hearing that he's considered a monster.
Yeah.
So it's always kind of been my goal for the whole thing, is to set the record straight as far as the pieces of the puzzle, putting them together, helping to put closure for the family, if that's possible, so that they can move forward, at least for Shanann's family. His family still hangs on to the fact that Shanann murdered the girls, and it just is not true.
Yeah.
She did not.
Yeah, and I think... I mean, that's very clear. And I don't know how much you know about me, but I do criminal defense work. I've been a criminal defense attorney for 25 years. And some people are still saying, oh,
okay,
Chris Watts didn't do it. Chris Watts didn't do it, or didn't kill the kids. And I keep trying to tell them, yes, he pled guilty to it. Mm. Okay. He pled guilty to it. So he admits as a matter of law and as a matter of fact that that's what happened. And he's repeated that not only in his guilty plea to the court, but to his interview to the FBI. And now in his own letters to you, he acknowledges that he did it.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Hopefully this will put to rest the debate, although I don't think there should be any debate as to whether he killed, you know, Bella and Celeste. He did. He admits it and explains how he did it. Now, some people, you know, it's going to be, they're never going to believe it. But when you get it from repeatedly these multiple occasions, I think, you know, is he trying to cover for somebody? Who does he have to cover for? And we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But let me ask you this.
Exactly.
How much time did you spend with the Shanann's family and Chris's family in preparing for this book?
I reached out to the Ruzacks at the beginning of the book, and I don't think they quite understood what I was doing. Maybe I never did get to talk to them personally. I left a message for them, and then their attorney called me, and they declined having anything to, you know, a part in a voice in the book. And that was okay, because it was only a very few months after the murders, and I understood their pain. There was no offense taken at all. However, Cindy Watts contacted me between the first or the second letter that I wrote Christopher and until I had wrote him back to let me know that Christopher really wanted her to let me know that he would like to see me. He would like to send me the form to come and see him, and that he was interested in me writing his story. So I've never met Cindy or Ronnie, but I've talked to them on the phone. And as we went through that period of time when I was outlining the book and putting things together, when Cindy and her daughter mainly saw that they could not control the narrative, I was pretty much dumped by them. And that's okay, because they were not going to control the narrative of this book.
Okay.
I wanted the truth and the facts to be out.
Okay. And I guess that's what a good, do you consider yourself an investigative kind of writer? Or, I mean, it sounds like you're just like, hey, these are the facts. Let the chips fall where they may. You weren't out here to tell once, you weren't an advocate for either side. You were just, here's the facts and here's what he had to say.
Right. I like true crime. And I felt like as Christopher and I went through this process, and of course, things that I had no idea that I was going to be hearing, I realized that the story was much more than his story of redemption and that he came to God. There was a story there that was very wrong that he withheld from specifically her family. They were already hurt. How could you be hurt any more than what, you know, had happened? But he owed it to them to give them the truth. And he knew there would be some things in the book that would be released that I, you know, that I would write that he wasn't going to be the happiest with. But he wrote the letters. He wrote the story when it comes to what he did. Yeah. And he wanted to be part of the book. So, yeah, I'm not necessarily an investigator. I just really like true crime. I like finding all the research I can on it. And
okay,
this one just kind of wrote itself.
Yeah, no, you stated in the book that you wrote him, I believe, a couple of times, and there was no response. And in fact, one of the letters, he apologizes for getting your letters and not responding because there was mention of a book, and he thought, no way. And then he came around, and then that's, I guess, when this correspondence began. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you went to see Chris Watts in prison. Tell me about that, the first time you met him.
Well, the first time meeting him, I was kind of shocked because he didn't look anything like he looked on the interview on the front porch that morning. He had shaved his facial hair. He's pretty much almost totally gray. He looked smaller. He looked boyish. And he couldn't look me in the eye. And so it was very kind of disturbing for me. And I did, the very first meeting I had with him, I said, Christopher, why can't you look me in the face when you talk to me? Because it's annoying to me if someone can't look at you, you know? And he said, well, it's not you. I've always been this way. I have a hard time looking someone in the face. And so that's fine. So we went from there. And the very first day that I sat down to talk with him and we made the deal of what to do, he started pouring out things about the crime. And some of it, as you see, is very shocking. It's just not, it's just heart-wrenching, actually.
Yeah.
So now, it's hard to hear.
Well, it is. I mean, and I can't tell you how many people I forgot, I've lost count, that have been, you know, accused of murder. And it's never easy when they sit there and they, for lack of a better term, kind of come clean and tell you how it happened and what they did. And I think this case particularly, for me, I thought was the manner of death, strangulation. Okay. We're not talking, you know, you shoot somebody and it's over. It's strangulation. You're right. Standing above somebody. You're holding, you're choking them. They may pass out between, you know, 20 seconds to a minute, but to actually kill somebody through strangulation can take minutes, you know, five
right.
minutes. So it's very personal. It's very rage, you know, And so I think that was the part that really interests me. And it's like I said, it's had you ever talked with anybody that directly who had, you know, had confessed to committing murder?
Oh, no, I haven't. And I got to tell you, Scott, I don't know how you do it. You have to be extremely strong, because this one case has changed me and it has affected me in such a great way. I don't know how you do it all the time.
When you say it's changed you or affected you, how so?
Well, it's one thing. I had a really hard time sleeping for a while. And when I did fall asleep, I would dream about the case and dream about the things that he said to me. I had back and forth feelings of empathy for him, in the sense that he's traumatized, but he traumatized himself. And then anger myself at him for what he did. And I can't get the girls out of my mind. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter myself, and I would never want anyone. I don't even want her to skin her knee. I can't imagine anyone ever hurting her.
Yeah.
And so it's just something I can't get out of my mind. It's just something that over and over I've played in my mind, how he could have possibly put his hands around those baby girls and done to them what he did. It just,
yeah. And like I said, I think one of the reasons why this case captured the attention and still does, you know, here we are a year and a half, basically later, from when this all happened, is the mere fact that it just violates so many, norms that we have. One is obviously you don't go killing people. You hope you're not going to kill your spouse, but more tragically is the death of the children, is so, it's just so, people don't do that. I mean, parents have a job in life, and that is to protect their children. I don't care whether it's us humans or anywhere in nature, but what do the parents or the mother always does is they protect their children throughout. And for a parent to actually do that, I think it makes just people, it shocks the conscience is what it really does.
Right. It was interesting to me. One time he made the comment to me that he had read and learned that parents just don't kill children, their children. And of course we know it happens, but it was interesting that he had to look that up. He had to read about that without knowing his instinct should have been there to not kill his children. So
yeah, that's shocking to me. And I think at one point in your book that he had mentioned or came out that he had an IQ of 140, which is pretty high, if I know
high.
It. But for him not to be able to know that. And I mean, do you think this, I mean, he was a mechanic, apparently, you know, mechanical, very smart in that regard, but his social functioning, how did you relate his social functioning to somebody that was supposedly, you know, according on paper, smart?
Well, they don't exactly go together. I mean, I don't, you know, he says he was tested coming into the prisons and that was his score was 140, and he may be book smart. I don't doubt that, because I will tell you he has extreme recall of things that he reads. I have never heard anyone quote the Bible like the guy does. He can quote scripture after scripture after scripture. It's just kind of amazing. And or anything that he reads, he can almost verbally tell you, write the book right back to you. It was just unreal. But he doesn't have common sense. And what really struck me about his social skills is I think he was so controlled his whole life. And I'm not talking Shanann, I'm talking before that. His thoughts were controlled, or at least were tried. They tried to control his thoughts to the point that he has leaned upon someone all of his life to tell him what to do next, and what decision to make. So if that's common sense, I don't know. It's
Well, he's definitely going to get that in prison. They're going to tell him what time to get up, what time to go to bed, what time to eat. So he's going to certainly have that structure back again. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's too bad that people had to lose their life so that he could get that structure, isn't it? I mean, it's terrible.
Awful.
So how many times did you actually go see him in prison?
3 times. I've spent a total of 15 hours with him in person. I didn't even know how many phone calls. He was calling me 3 times a week. Then it went down to 2 times. And then as the book was done, he would call once a week. I talked to him. It'll be 2 weeks tomorrow was my last conversation with him. And then the mini letters that he sent me. The letters were 10, 12 pages long, where he just kind of poured things out to me, as you see, just reading the book. And he wrote the Ruzaks a letter because he's never apologized to them. And actually, one thing that I did not put in the book, I can tell you that not long before the book was released, I said to him, Christopher, the letters that you sent me that you had wrote to Shanann and the girls, there's nowhere in those letters that you have said you're sorry. And I think that says something, and that bothers me, and I think it will bother the public. I think the public will see that and question that. And he's like, I didn't say I was sorry. And I said, no, you haven't. And I think you need to. So he said, well, I'll write them in a story and you can insert it into a letter. I thought that was just interesting because does that mean he's not sorry?
That's very interesting. Yeah, it is. That's also curious. I did a video. It's kind of a, you know, my rules to live by for life. And the first one is there's 2 types of people in the world. First, those that are humble and those that are about to be. And but later on down the list is it's amazing how far the words I'm sorry can go.
That's for sure.
And people just don't always realize that. And, you know, I've never spoken to the Ruzaks. I've had a couple of them. I think the son, when we put some things up on video and he didn't like them, would make comments or something to that effect. But, you know, it's nothing personal. It's the facts. It's public. It's a public story. People want to know about it. We're not out here speculating on these outrageous theories that people are, you know, coming up with. It's like, these are the facts. I deal in reality.
Right.
And the reality of it is, like you said, the fact that he didn't say I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist or anything, but that really kind of goes to kind of a very antisocial, you know, type of personality that it's, what do you mean I didn't say I'm sorry? You know, I didn't realize I didn't say I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't even think about that. So that's very, very, very interesting. So I've been to lots of prisons, and I'm assuming you'd never been to a prison before. Would that be a fair statement?
Never. Never a prison, never a jail. I've been on jury duty, but never in a jail.
Yeah, so you go to the paperwork, you probably had to go through the metal detectors and the doors. And, you know, the first thing I always notice is, you know, obviously how clean they are because, you know, they got a lot of staff or they have a lot of people that can clean. So when you get done cleaning that hallway, why don't you start cleaning that hallway again? The places are always spotless, and there's usually that certain cold dampness about it. Did you notice that when you went in?
Yes, yes, absolutely, yeah.
And
I just thought it was because the building was so old, but yeah, it was definitely cold and damp.
Cold and damp, and like I said, I've been to lots of prisons, and people are like, well, what's it like going in there? And, you know, you probably didn't go back to a pod, but, the room's usually a big one. I'm assuming it's probably a big open room, and you got to sit maybe across from him at a table or something to that effect, right? Okay.
Yeah, yes,
And sometimes there's always, if you go to, if you go to city jail, not so much the prisons, but city jails always have that fear, the smell of urine and baloney and fear going around. It's just, it's just a gross place. But so, you know, obviously a lot of people, and you mentioned in here, he was kind of shocked that people didn't want him to have pictures of his children and his wife, ex Shanann, there in jail. I think he said, right. I can't believe people would do that. You know, they'd have to do that for everybody. And I don't think it's that they don't want him to have pictures of his family. It's just the fact that he has pictures of the people that he murdered is what people were somewhat offended by. But he just didn't seem to get that either, did he?
No. And did you notice one of his comments in that letter to me was, I don't know why people would want to hurt me like that. And that stood out to me. I'm thinking, why people would want to hurt you like that? You kill, you know, four people, but you're worried about what people are going to hurt you with taking your pictures away. So I don't know. That just stood out to me when he said that.
I noticed that portion in the book, and it kind of goes back to the never saying you're sorry, because he just doesn't get it, does he?
I mean, right. No, it's like he doesn't.
Literally, like, he just turned the page. Okay, now I'm don't have a family anymore. I'm just in prison, and that's just the way it is. And he doesn't he's the one. I mean, I get that he says he understands why he got there or how he got there, but
I think we've lost some audio.
Oh, can you hear me?
Hello,
Kyle, can you hear me out? I can hear you. Hello. I can hear you, Sherilyn. Maybe you're back. Can you hear me now? I can hear you.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I wasn't sure what happened there. We hadn't touched anything. So
yeah, we kind of froze.
Yeah. So I had something come up here about your default speaker. Kyle came up here. You can still hear it. Still recording.
Yeah.
We're still good. Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Before we had a little bit of audio difficulty there, we were talking about how he just didn't understand why people wouldn't want him to have pictures of his family and they are hurting him. So kind of goes back once again, he just doesn't get it.
Right. And how could you not get it? There has to be something malfunctioning up there to not get that. You know?
Yeah. Now, when you went to see him, he was still in solitary. That's the way I read it in the book. Is that right?
Yes, the first time. Mm-hmm. The first and second time I saw him, he was still in protective confinement, he called it.
Yeah. Had he had any issues with other inmates, or is no problems that he told you about?
In the Wisconsin prison, oddly enough, he's pretty content. He's in a pod, he said, with handicapped inmates, about 17 in the pod that he's in. He still has his own cell, which he enjoys, having his own privacy, but then he can come out into the day room or whatever, and he gets to go outside, I think, 3 or 4 times a week. But he's oddly content with where he's at, so he hasn't had any problems with anyone where he's at in Wisconsin. Now, he did before he got to Wisconsin. He, not that he saw anyone and had any trouble one-on-one, but they screamed at him, he said, all the time, and telling him ways to kill himself and treated him really badly. Wanted to get to him if they could.
Okay.
I'm sure you've seen a lot of that type of thing, but you know,
There's a hierarchy. Yeah. There's a hierarchy in prison.
He was scared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, he should be. I mean, there's a hierarchy in prison.
I bet.
And people that kill children are, you know, not very high on that that platform of or a hierarchy of respect. That's for sure. So he's got something to worry about. The other thing I liked about your book is, you know, one, You came out to the realization, hey, he's pled guilty. But the second one was that you acknowledge, like, how do we know, and you kind of force, how do we know that he's telling the truth based on what he said earlier, based on what he's saying now? You know, why should we believe it? And once again, I like your sort of realistic attitude of it is, you know, it's up for you to decide, the reader to decide. I mean, I like that candor. Do you, I mean, can you explain why you put that in there?
Well, because I think all of us feel the same way. Is he telling the truth now? I think he is. I've sat across from him. I've listened to him. I've read his letters. I think he's telling the truth, but I'm not 100% positive. And those who read the story are going to have to find within their own mind what they're comfortable with believing. It's been such a big case, and so many people have been invested in their feelings and emotions with this case. So they're going to have to decide, do I take this as the final answer, so to speak, and this is the truth, or do I continue to search further and dig to try to find? He's never going to tell us some things, just flat out. He told me he's never going to tell who gave him the oxy. And then along the time of talking with him, he said, there are some things I will take to my death. And who knows what those could be?
Yeah, I mean,
some of them had to do with Nikki.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. So, and like I said, I've had lots of clients over the years that have been in, you know, similar type charges, and some they won't tell you everything. Some they tell you what they think you need to know, and even if you think they're telling you just about everything, there's always that one little nugget that they're usually holding back. So when you say, he says, yeah, I don't want to talk about that. And I've had clients that were literally, they'll tell you everything, and they'll get to the point and they're like, we're not going to talk about that. And they just won't talk about it. It's whatever's that deep, dark thing that they did or what brought it about. They don't want to discuss it. And like I said, I haven't talked to him, you know, personally. And so you know, I think perhaps, and like I said, this is not a puff piece for you. If I had read this and said, this is, you know, a hogwash, but you're laying it out there saying, readers, here's what we know. Here's in the public. Here's the letters that you all haven't seen. Mm-hmm. You decide. And that's, I mean, these are facts.
Right.
And they're going to make up their own mind. Some people will be completely dismissive of it, but you know what? You can't ignore the stuff. If you're interested in the case, let's look at it factually and for what it says, and not get off on some wild conspiracy theory that some people you know, want to get into in this particular case.
Yeah, always the conspiracy feeling or theories. You know, a part of it, I think people feel like they would like to be told that there was someone with him, an accomplice.
Yeah.
And they would love to be able to blame it on Nikki because she broke up his home. But Christopher had decisions to make, and he made some really, really bad. All of them were bad decisions.
Yeah.
Well, there's just no way we can blame anyone else. It was him.
Yeah. Let's talk about Nicole Kessinger, who is obviously, you know, it's undisputed that not in dispute that. She was having a relationship while they were still married, and she's one of the last people that, you know, he had spoken to before being arrested in texts and things like that. Did you ever talk to her for the book? Did you try to reach out to her?
I tried to find her. I cannot find her. I don't know. I've been told that she's under FBI protection. I don't know if I believe that or not. I think she's just changed her name, changed her looks, and moved somewhere where she feels like she can't be found. And so, no, I never got to speak with her.
Okay, and I've tried to look for her. I've tried to look for her myself, and I've had investigators do it. And you know, a lot of stuff is still coming back, not far from my office. You know, we can go by the parents' home, but no one's actually been able to see. Her at the parents' home too. So I'm of the mindset that you are, that she is gone. I don't, I don't buy the FBI witness protection thing. I don't.
No, I don't.
But
either.
I think she's disappeared, and you know, eventually she'll pop up, and maybe one day she'll tell her story as well. But obviously, that's kind of what led to this. I mean, he met Nicole Kessinger, and I guess I just don't understand it. Did he ever explain to you why he didn't just get a divorce instead of saying, hey, I can't have Nicole Kessinger and my wife and kids and family at the same time, so, you know, I have to kill my family? I mean, did you ever ask him point blank why he didn't just get a divorce?
I did, yeah.
What was his response?
Yeah, I did, and he doesn't know. He doesn't know was all that he would ever tell me. He wanted to be with her so badly that he says he just couldn't, like, function. You know, he feels something dark came over him and was making him do these things and put this into his head. And he planned it for 3 or 4 weeks because this darkness that was in him. And then he'll say, well, you know, she was dark. And then he gave a Bible scripture. I don't remember, Matthew, I think, or I don't remember. I put it in the book where basically it talks about a woman that is kind of a prostitute or a married prostitute, if you will. I don't know. She just, and he likened Nicole to that Bible character. And that if you want to see what Nicole is like, read this scripture, and that's who Nicole is. But then you're going to tell me that you loved her so much, and then tell me that there were some horribly bad things that went on in her apartment, at her house when he was with her, that again, he will take to his death. He will not talk about all of the things that they did. I don't know what that means.
Okay. But he, did you get the sense that he was trying to protect Ms. Kessinger? I mean, it seems very clear he acted on his own from his statements. I mean, did mm-hmm. you get the feeling that, I mean, like I said, in one sentence, he was completely infatuated and in lust with this woman and he couldn't function and he had to be with her. So he jumped from that faulty logic, if that's what you say, that only way I could be with her is to kill her, my family, to be with her, to she has a darkness about her. I mean, did you get the feeling? And I understand this is your own opinion, speculation, but was he covering for anybody? Or is it, I did it and I just really wanted to be with her.
He's protective of her and he's protective of his family, as in his sister and his mom and dad. But, and he's told me that he still loves Nicole. He still feels a love for her. So I guess that's what makes him kind of protective of her. But as you see, you know, in the letters, he did talk about her and the things that she did that he feels led him to do what he did. And I told him flat out, that sounds a little bit like an excuse. And he says, no, I'm not blaming her. I'm just saying that these are the things that caused me to get off track. And then he would say, well, for 3 months before the murders happened, I didn't pray on my way to work every day. And I used to always pray on my way to work. And so I stopped that. So that's why this happened to me. And just doesn't sound logical thinking to me.
And obviously Chris Watts claims that he's found religion while in custody. And he, I guess, says, you know, obviously, you know, was somewhat religious beforehand, you know, he looks back now, and at least through the book, that he makes it sound as if he's had all these signs and these were signs from God and, you know, why he shouldn't be going to see Nicole and things of that nature. You know, and there's a quote out there that says, you know, the converts are the most devout. And it seems like, has he kind of converted, so to speak? I mean, he's he's all in.
Yeah. I mean, you would be able to speak into that more than me. I'm sure you've seen a lot of jailhouse religion. And so how much of it is from that, from being incarcerated and turning to God, and how much, you know, if he was to get out today, would he still be religious? Would he still have God in his life? You know, I don't know. I can't judge that, but, you know, in speculating, I think maybe it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. He, yeah, I mean, I like I said, I've, the jails and prisons, the jails, I would say, because that's before they get sentenced, is probably one of the most holiest places on earth because everybody finds religion there. The question is do they keep on it? Yeah. And I'm not saying one way, you know, if it makes you a better person, you know, whatever religion you do, then
yeah.
that's a good thing. And if yoga makes you a better person, then, you know, just do it. So whatever makes you a better person.
Right.
And so the right. question's always, okay, when you're not in custody and you have, you know, nothing to do all day, are you going to be able to continue to do it? You know, to, I guess, demonstrate the discipline, so to
right.
speak.
Right.
You told, he mentions in the book, and I think it's a little bit different from his FBI interview when they came to see him, see the Carter Bureau of Investigation, but he'd been planning this for a while, at least, I mean, almost immediately after meeting Nicole Kessinger, he starts getting this crazy notion that I got to kill everybody. Did he expand upon that further?
Yeah, this started like, he did. I mean, he said that, you know, the thoughts were in his mind for 3 or 4 weeks about killing. First, Shanann was his original thoughts was to kill her. And then as, you know, the time went on, then to kill the girls also to free himself, I guess, and start over. And how he thought he could do that and start over and live a life, I just, outside of prison, I just don't understand that. But he had been planning this for a little while. And I think his plan that morning, and this is my opinion, so this is not in the book, but I think his plan was foiled, what he had originally planned, because when the girls woke up after he had tried to kill them, and he said that they woke up, I think it threw him into a real tailspin. He became very upset and very angry that they got back up. He decided last minute to, I think, to take them out to the oil batteries. And I think when he grabbed the gas can, it was to burn the bodies. It wasn't necessarily, he was not going to kill himself. He did not have intentions ever of killing himself. But I think he was going to burn the bodies, which I think Sandy Ruzek had that feeling. I think if you want to talk about somebody maybe that more has God in their life, that she got the feeling that he was going to burn his family up. And out of the, and then he makes the comment, well, there was too many people that lived around that area that would could be hurt by a big fire at the oil batteries. Mm-hmm. It just didn't make sense to me. But
yeah, because we've been out yeah. to the oil batteries, and they're kind of out there in the middle of you know, nowhere. You got to work pretty hard to get out there. So yeah, that doesn't really make sense. And you know, there's you know, obviously you've listened to his interviews when they came, the police went up and talked to him. You know, some of what he told you is different. Did you?
Yeah.
Call him out on that and say, why is this different from what you told Carter Bureau Investigation and FBI?
I did. And he told me that's because they surprised him and showed up that day at the prison and questioned him and then told him that his answers and that interview would go no further than just with them. And then it ended up, you know, all over. But he said he was upset that they surprised him and he didn't feel like he owed him anything because he had been sentenced to life and he was in prison. The case was over and he didn't. And he told me actually the first letter that he wrote me back was that he took the opportunity to clear Shanann's name when they came out to see him mm-hmm. and that he did feel really bad that he had gotten that idea from the FBI to blame Shanann.
Yeah.
And so he took that opportunity to clear her name.
Yeah, and that was so obvious.
But that was the reason why things were different.
That was so obvious in his interview tape that, you know, he wasn't even thinking about that. And, you know, and that goes back to, I could do a whole, mm-hmm. whole you know, hours on the Reed interrogation technique and just to get him to admit a little bit. And then he kind of jumped on it and played on it and thinking it was going to somehow help him when in fact, you know, it didn't. Did he ever talk to you as to why he never got an attorney, just kept his mouth shut? I mean, for a guy that he says now claims that he's a genius, man, he's dumb.
Yes, and did some very dumb things, especially after the murders. But, you know, he was relying on his parents where the attorney was concerned. Mm-hmm. And his dad told him that night at the precinct, I guess, where they were at, where he was being questioned, "Oh, we're going to find a really good lawyer for you, son," he says. And we're going to, you know, but he ended up with a public defender, which he liked them. He said they were good to him. They treated him well. And I guess that's all he needed is just for someone to treat him well. I don't know. He just, as far as I know, it was never discussed.
Yeah. I was just, you know, curious why he never, you know, did that. And obviously he got an attorney. It was already, you know, too late. And I'm not trying to say he could have got away with it, but I'm saying is that, you know, most people, and this happens a lot of time to people that are charged, is they just think they're smarter than everybody else in the room. I mean, did he think he was going to get away with it? I mean, you know, you saw that interview the first day. Oh, I don't know what happened to her. And the video's in the house where he's just kind of acting nonchalant. And, you know, the police knew from the beginning he was the prime suspect.
Yeah, he was cocky that morning, I thought, and just almost like a smile on his face as he talked about it, like he thought he could get away with it. And then he told me, well, as the days went by, had he not been kind of, I don't want to say forced, because I don't believe he was forced, but forced according to either the death penalty or life in prison, he was going to confess anyway, he said, had they not done that to him. I don't know whether I believe that or not. I think if he thought he could have gotten away with it, he would have.
Well, that was, he had already confessed to the murder of his wife, and the best he could have got, you know, and so for the sake of argument, that you could have beat the charges as it relates to his children, he still confessed to killing Shanann. To the police.
Right.
And then, at the most you get is second degree assault or heat of passion or something along those lines. So, you know, just from the from the criminal defense perspective, you know, you're just sitting there, you're just like scratching your head, and you know, the family didn't have any money to retain private counsel. And they went with the public defender, but it didn't matter at that point because he'd already confessed. He never
confessed. Yeah.
Never, bothered to request. So let's talk about this kind of a new revelation that comes out in the book. And that's regarding, he tries to cause a miscarriage by giving Shanann OxyContin. And I thought I knew this case, but I don't remember ever seeing that information before. So this is new, is it not?
It was new for me.
Okay.
In fact, in the very beginning, when he was telling me about that, I was confused, and I'm like, I didn't hear that story. You know, Christopher, tell me about that. So the first time he told me he gave it to her two times. Mm-hmm. Once at her parents' house, and then the second time the morning of the murders. But then later he said, no, I just gave it to her once.
Yeah.
So all of that was new information for me. I think others have heard it. I don't know how they heard it, but I didn't know it.
Did he clarify? I don't recall reading that, and it's possible, you know, if somebody has a page site or something. I just don't recall that ever being said.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so what's his final answer? It was a one time that he gave it to her, or the second time when he, you know, the night or the morning before she was killed?
Well, the last time that he told me, he said, no, he only gave it to her once. So I don't know. Is it in the autopsy?
Well, not because
she had, because he makes the comment that it was in the autopsy.
Yeah. So I read that, and he had said that he had given her OxyContin the morning of, and he says, and that's why it was in the autopsy report. And I went back and pulled a copy of the autopsy report that I got straight from the coroner in this mm-hmm. particular case. And the toxicology mm-hmm. reports from spleen blood was the ethanol and then the blood alcohol concentration. There's no workup whatsoever of in the workup relating to OxyContin, which would have had a presence for some sort of opioid or benzoid kind of thing. And and then I went back to the autopsy for the girls as well, and all the toxicology in their reports was everything that you find in gasoline, which would make sense because, or you know, the crude oil, because they were retrieved from those tanks. You know, there's benzene, ethyl benzene, toluene, mm-hmm. exolines, hexane, methylphenamine. You know, I mean, and I looked all those up before, mm-hmm. and it's all stuff that's in petroleum products. So, it's not there. So I don't know if maybe he read it somewhere, maybe he was hoping that would come, or maybe he thinks it helps him look better. But that statement's certainly not corroborated by the autopsy.
And he told me, and I did not put this in the book because I could not find any proof of it, but he says that there was an extension to the autopsies of all three, Shanann and the two girls, that was not released. And I would have no way of knowing how to get that information if that's true. And why they would not release all of it.
Yeah, well, now I'm intrigued because, you know, when we spoke with the coroner's office and we had the release, this was what was released. I went one step further and tried to request everything, the autopsy notes, photos, and everything like that, and they just flat out refused giving those to me. And I would think any of the other toxicology reports, if something had come back further, that would have been released. I mean, there was nothing about that. But now I'm intrigued, and now Monday morning, we're going to have to follow up on that. So we'll see if there's a supplemental to it. The other thing,
you know,
go ahead.
Also, he told me that one of the conditions for his plea deal was that he would seal the girls' medical records, and that no one could ever look into the medical records again. Do you know?
You know, no. And there was a filing early on where the attorneys for Chris Watts filed something to the effect with the court that it sounds like they were in possession of some sort of medical records. Now, if there was something like that, that would have to have been on the record because that was part of the agreement. Now, most people aren't going to be able to get a medical record for anyone prior to all of this incident relating to them because of the HIPAA laws. But mm-hmm. the coroner's report is considered a public record. So other reports, you know, medical records, I don't see how anybody could get those. So, but as far as being part of the plea deal, that would have had to been on the record with the court if it was going to be something that was binding for that.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. And again, that's why I didn't put it in the book, because unless I know it's fact, I didn't want to put it there.
I understand. So. Let's talk about something that you brought up, and he puts in one of his letters to you. The whole picture that he sent to Shanann about the dolls.
Yes.
Share with him what Chris Watts told you about this.
Well, the picture was taken. I'm trying to think back now because I've heard it both ways. One by his mom and one by him. But I think he told me that he is the one who took the picture.
Yeah, I mean, in your book, on page 86, it says that Christopher took a picture of the doll while Shanann was in Arizona.
His mom says that she took the picture and sent it to him. then. That's the controversy that there was there. He says it was just a funny thing, that it was nothing meant by that. I totally don't believe that, because he was already thinking about killing the girls. So, of course, there was a meaning behind that.
Yeah. It's certainly, I thought, one of the more unusual things. I mean, I can't imagine I would send that picture to, your wife and say, hey, isn't this funny? Little dolls, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a little weird. And, you know, like I said, I'll represent anybody. I will represent, defend their constitutional rights under, our Constitution to make sure they get a fair trial. And if they want to plead guilty or go to trial, that's fine. But he just seems like a real odd duck. There's like, I don't know if there's something just not wired right. Like I said, kind of maybe an antisocial personality type of thing. Did he say whether his attorneys ever did any sort of psychological or psychiatric evaluation on him at all for mitigation purposes?
They did not do anything. And he says that they didn't because they didn't want him to have that done. His story is they told him if he had that done, everything about that would come out in court. But I mean, what more can you get than a time life sentence? So I don't understand that.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me. If they were considering maybe a not guilty by reason of insanity, then there would be evaluations and that could come out. But I hire psychiatrists all the time for my clients for exploring potential defenses, as well as mitigation purposes, if they have, mental health issues and things of that nature. So that case moved way too quickly, but if that's what the client wants to do, so be it. You know, he says, hey, you know, he tells him, hey, I did it. I'm going to plead guilty. It's the client's choice. So that's it. But, that would be one of the first things that I would have jumped on right away was to, figure out what is making this guy tick. What made this guy snap, for a better reason? Because Nicole Kessinger just couldn't have been that great to say, I'm going to go kill somebody. You know what I mean? Something else. There had to be something else there that snapped. It wasn't just, wow, the sex is really good. Let me go kill my family. Okay, go get a divorce. Walk away. Don't come back. Run away. But, I just don't understand how he got to that point. Did he ever give you any indication as to why he made that leap or why he thought that would be a good idea or anything?
No. I mean, I said to him, Christopher, there are millions of people who get divorces. They walk away from their spouse for whatever reason, and the kids are okay. I mean, the kids would have been fine. Shanann was a good enough mom. She would have went on, would have done all right. And he just says, I don't know why I did it other than, I wanted to be with Nikki. This darkness came over me. He never really could give a reason what he was thinking.
Yeah, I mean...
And why he had to make that choice.
He's not the first guy in the world, nor will he be the last that goes out and has an affair and thinks he's, having a midlife crisis. So, fine, you find yourself a girlfriend, go buy yourself a convertible, but you don't kill your family. And that's the part that I think is just, it doesn't make sense. And did he give you any indication of when he was growing up? Did he ever do anything weird that we see in people that, really kind of crack with, did he abuse, animals? Did he like to burn things? Anything like that?
He didn't say anything like that. His mother, of course, the only thing she will say is he was just such a good child. He was so... always did what he was told. That's not normal in itself, but she would talk about how he would go into she could hear him like in the bathroom or something, and she could hear him asking God to forgive him over and over and over again. And then she would tell me how she would try to get into his head, basically, and make him tell her, what is it that is on your mind? What are you thinking? She didn't do it just the times that he was being heard confessing. She wanted to do it on a daily basis. She wanted to know what he was thinking about. And I think was after him all the time about that. And so he said, well, you know, she felt like I loved my dad more than I loved her. And she wanted to know what I was thinking all the time. And it was just hard for me to tell her what I was thinking. It's just not normal to me. I mean, what a 15, 16, 17 year old boy is going to tell his mom what he's thinking, you know, it just isn't going to happen. And so, but I think he was kind of really hounded about that.
Yeah.
And that's why she's having such a hard time now. She still wants to know.
Yeah. I mean, I think all parents, you know, beat themselves up and feel guilty if their children do something, you know, where did I go wrong? What could I have done? And they don't want to admit mm-hmm. that their son could have done something like this. I mean, that's also a reality of it, because they're going to blame themselves. So while we're on the subject of Nikki, I believe he said in his interview to the police when they came up to the prison to talk with him that he wondered whether some of the letters that he was receiving, if maybe that one was Nicole Kessinger. Did he elaborate on that more?
He did. He would talk about wondering if she was writing to him like in a code or something. And he had one person that was writing him from Kauai, and he doesn't know who she was or how she got interested in him, but she would write him letters and write things on postcards that was just like they knew each other almost. And she would talk about, I don't know what this has to do with anything, but she would talk about banana bread a lot, which banana bread is kind of a staple in Hawaii. You know, I don't know why that was a big issue for him. And she kept writing about that, about the banana bread. So he was wondering if it was a code for something, if she wrote to him in a code. And her name was Laurel, I think was her name. I saw a couple of the postcards that she had written him. But he was always wondering if she's going to contact him, how she still feels about him, and if she will eventually show up in his life, you know.
Yeah.
Delusional, I think.
Somewhat, yeah. Now, did he say how many people he had writing him while he's been in prison?
Oh my, he has a fan base. I'm going to tell you, at one point he was getting dozens of letters a day, and that has backed off some, but he does get a lot of mail. And it's funny because I started realizing he is so regimented with the way he does things, that he was calling me on certain days. So if he didn't get a hold of me, he wouldn't try the next day. He had to wait until the next appointed time to call me. And not that we agreed any certain day, because we didn't. He could call whenever he wanted to. But he has so many people that he was calling and so many people that he is writing to, that he has to schedule it out, who he writes today and who he calls today. Just bizarre that he cares so much about what people think of him, that the fact that he's got this fan base is really important to him, that he, you know, he has these women that love him and another set of women that just minister to him and basically kind of a girlfriend that he's got. And
has he had other women who are potential love interests come and see him?
There's one that seems to have a real interest in him. I've asked her point blank, you know, do you love him? Are you in love with him? And she will deny it, but she sees him weekly and she comes to his defense, like a mother would come to her little child's defense, or like, you know, like you'd come to your husband's defense. So, I guess only
what's she defending? What's she defending him about? I mean, he's pled guilty. He says he's told the police, he's told the court, he's told you in letters that he killed everybody. What could she possibly defend him? Like just saying he's not the monster that everybody makes him out to be.
Exactly. And she was very upset with me that I put the letters in my book, even though he wrote them. And I have a document from him that he sent kind of out of the blue in July that says, Sherilyn Cadle has my permission to write or to use any and all correspondence that I have sent to her for the purpose of writing the book. And so, but this girl is just, you know, she just gets so angry with me that I basically opened up the truth, and why did I do that to him? And now he's in such a horrible state. He's having so much, you know, problems with this. And it's not normal to me to defend someone like that when you know what he's done. Who was able to defend Shanann and the girls, you know, against him? So I don't think he has a right to ask
For
me to defend him.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm assuming you have all the original letters. You have the letters that say inmate mail from the prison, the way they normally come.
Yes.
So if anybody doubts that you had anything, you could produce everything. Is that right?
I did. And I gave it, I gave Daily Mail the one letter, and then I allowed them to look at the other letters when they were here. I also am taking the letters and putting them into a notebook under clear sleeves. And as I do book signings, if people would like to look at the letters, they are welcome to do that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I certainly would like to, you know, talk to the guy. I mean, just my curiosity as a criminal defense attorney, and just kind of generally my experience with clients over the years, it's always curious to see what makes somebody tick. And was it just a complete aberration, a one-time somebody loses their stuff, so to speak, or was really this person just not wired right? And I think that's the intriguing thing is we, you know, you can hear about the Charles Mansons and the Bundys, and you know, you kind of like, there's just so many of them. It's like, okay, there, you could see it happening. That's just pure evil. And then you see a guy that snaps once, you know, like, was it only once? Was there something else? Maybe he got away with, you know, you like, you just don't know. And that's, I think the curiosity thing is what makes this guy tick? Because, you know, what does a murderer look like? Does he look like a Ted Bundy that is, you know, went to law school, well, you know, spoken, educated, so to speak,
right?
Or is it the Charles Manson guy? You know, what do they look like? Mm-hmm. You can't just say, oh, that one person is going to kill or that one is not. Give me your, where do you think he's not telling the truth based upon what you've said? Or do you think, hey, this is what I've got, whether it's the truth or not? Well, maybe we'll never know for sure, but this is what he told me. That's kind of what your book is telling me.
Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I believe that he has given me the truth. And are there some things he hasn't come forward with? Maybe, you know, the things that he says he'll take to his death, I think have a little bit more around protecting someone else. Maybe, I don't know for sure, but I do believe he's told me the truth. Who could make up what he's done? Who could make up that story? It's just so awful. And so I do believe he's told me the truth. If there's some things hidden, I think it has more to do with his affair, maybe, and maybe more to do with his family. I don't know.
Okay.
For sure. They played such a part in their dislike, you know, for Shanann that
correct.
I don't know if there's something there he's trying to protect. So.
Yeah. And you would think if he was going to, you know, come clean, if there was somebody else involved, which I don't think so. I mean, you know, people may have suggested, wow, it'd be great if we were mm-hmm. together. Wow, it would be great if we could start all over and we didn't have all this baggage of an ex-wife and kids and child support. But that's not mm-hmm. enough to say, go kill somebody, okay? And I know a lot of people want...
No, because you're not...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You're not going to have that freedom if you kill your family to be with that other person. Yeah. So was she the driving force or was it that he just wanted out? I don't know. I mean, yeah. A psychological exam might tell us more. I wish he would have one.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people want Nicole Kessinger charged. And there's no doubt that Michael Rourke, the district attorney in Weld County, and the police would charge her if they thought that there was something that they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she did or encouraged him to
right.
do. And it's just not there. You know,
right.
it happens all the time. You know, oh, she deleted emails. Well, guess what? You can look at the Amber Geiger trial this last week, and she deleted emails too. does that mean she's guilty? No, people
right.
do that all the time. So
right.
I get people's frustration, and they wanted to, but we also have the courts, the due process, and the presumption of innocence. So I get people's frustration mm-hmm. with that. So I'll kind of wrap things up here, but one of the more bizarre letters that I found in the book was the one on December 17th, 2018, where he writes Shanann, Bella, Celeste, and Nico. And mm-hmm. it's just weird the way, in my opinion, that he writes it. Like, you know, he's away at a job site, but he'll be home soon. I mean, it's
right.
goes back to the whole point where does this guy get that he killed his unborn child, his wife, and his two daughters? I mean, I think that's what he said. It's like the whole thing of, I'm sorry. Yeah, I can say I did it, but am I sorry for it?
Yeah. You know, there's such a narcissism with him that, I don't know. He talks about his family like they were in a car accident almost, instead of the fact that, you know, that he did it with his own hands. Yes, he's confessed to it, but does he really believe that their death is his sole responsibility in the fact that he will continue to recognize it or push it back, as in talking about them in present tense or, you know, dreams that he has of them or them being in his cell? He told me about the one day that he had the long conversation with Shanann in his cell. And I don't know, to me, it's all a form of a denial. And maybe that's what he needs to do to keep from going insane. Maybe it's a protection of his own mind. I don't know.
He's trying to rationalize it in his own mind that mm-hmm. I'm here, but I'm not a bad person. And that's what I...
Right.
have found and represent, you know, we're not talking about the person that commits a DUI, or we're talking people that have represented, you know, that have committed. They need that rationalization that, okay, I've done bad things, but I'm not the bad guy here. And they
exactly.
need that. They
You've
need that to kind of live on. With themselves. And so I think that's
right.
always somewhat interesting how they kind of rationalize to it. And, you know,
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, well, Sherilyn, I as I told you at the beginning, I was a little skeptical. I didn't know what to expect from mm-hmm. your book at the beginning. When I got an advanced copy, I started going through it, and I thought it was a very good summary of the factual information and the way you were able to weave in your conversations with Chris Watts. And I'm sure you've seen it. You're going to get a lot of heat from people that one way or the other. But I thought it was a very straightforward book. You're not an advocate for either side. You're not an advocate for Chris and being apologetic. It's his words. And I like your attitude of, hey, I'm one of the few people, other than his attorneys, that have spoken with Chris Watts, and I'm just telling you what he wrote to me. And so I like the fact that you're putting that information out there and you're not putting a whole lot of spin on it. In fact, you're pretty straightforward about it, saying he killed his family. He's not a good guy.
Right.
And you're not trying to out here saying, you know, he's found God and he saved himself, so he should be let free or something along those lines as well. So I find
not
it.
Not at all. Mm-mm.
So for your first book, I thought it was I thought it was very good. And I really do wish you the best. Why don't you put in a quick plug where people can get the book and when?
Well, it is being shipped now by Amazon. And in, I think, a couple of days, it'll also be for their e-readers. But you can get it for $19 off of Amazon and free shipping. Or you can go to the Dorrans website where they've had a well, it's not anymore. It wouldn't be a pre-sale because the book is now basically launching. So some people got their books yesterday, I'm told.
Okay.
Through Amazon. It will be in the Barnes and Noble's stores in a few days.
Okay.
If they want to go pick it up, you know, the store itself.
Do you have any
in other places? I don't know where else.
Do you have any book signings coming up?
I do. They're starting in my local area first. It'll be in, and then on into Chicago area. I have a big interview coming up in New York at the end of the week, and I'll be doing a book signing in New York. So just kind of taking it as it comes to me. I have a lot of interviews that have been scheduled. And so
well,
just take it a day at a time.
I understand. Well, I wish you the best of luck. I think, like I said, I think you went at it with open eyes. And like I said, you didn't go in with a way to make Chris Watts look good or bad. He did the bad on his own. And like I said, you're one of the few people that have actually talked to him. And this is what he said. This is what he wrote to you. You have the letters. And whether people like it or not, that is what it is. And there will be haters. I assure you of that. I get it all the time. If I say something people don't like, it doesn't comport to their theory. I'm unsubscribing from you. I'm not going to do it. Okay, but you can't change the facts. So I wish you well. Thank you for taking the time today. Thank you for your publisher for sending me the book so I could read early and, you know, hopefully have a, I hope it was an interesting conversation with you. And
yeah,
if you
enjoyed it.
If you make it to the Denver area, please let me know. I would love to have you here, you know, my studio here in my law office. And maybe we could do it again and talk about how the book is doing. So I wish you the best of luck. And Monday morning, we'll put our interview out there of you. So that was our agreement, and that's what we'll do. Okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Scott. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.